Good afternoon. So, last time we finished up covering AT&T syntax. We mentioned big differences. We had our destination register last, not first as you would have been used to from Intel syntax. We used this dollar to represent all constants. We didn't have a dollar sign. And we saw a number that would generally be an example of this syntax here with everything but the number omitted, or maybe without the everything but the number omitted. We always put a percent sign in front of registers, and we saw a name without a percent sign that was a label. And we learned that labels, which you probably had used before in 2150, well, the way they worked is that you had the thing that was labeled, and that would be placed somewhere in memory when we made an executable, and when you use the label elsewhere, that would be replaced with the location at which it was placed in memory. Just as if you had typed in the actual address that ends up. That's something, as we'll discuss probably next time, is done as part of making an executable. Then we talked about some tricky things, one of which was LEA, which you probably saw before in 2150 at some point. But it's a big source of confusion. And LEA stands for load effective address. And the effective address is the address an instruction computes to access data. So we can think of like a normal move from memory to register or vice versa instruction has an effective address. This is where it's reading or writing the memory. For the LEA instruction, it computes an effective address, but rather than actually accessing memory at that location, it just uses it to store into its destination. We also mentioned this sort of funny special register, which x86-64 calls RIP, which is the program counter, or as they put it, instruction pointer, which is typically something you'll see used in a move or LEA address computation, where the idea is that, oh, we have some data that's stored at some offset from this piece of code that we want to use. I mentioned that if you're reading assembly source files, there's this very special case, which is kind of confusing, where you'll see label %RIP, which sounds like I'm going to take the address of something at the address of the following instruction together, compute a new address that way, but that's not what it does. It's just a very special case that it is the same as if you type label, except the machine code is going to tell the processor to compute the address in a different way. So questions about these things we covered last time? Okay, not seeing any. So there's one thing that's just should just be review from 2150, which is the calling convention, and we're going to be concerned with 64-bit x86 on Linux. If some of those things change, this slide would have to change. And a calling convention is where, well, if we're writing assembly code, meaning probably we're a compiler or an operating system writer, so we're generating assembly code, we need to decide how functions work. And the processor doesn't really tell us, like, where do we put arguments, right? We could put arguments in all sorts of places, and as long as I, the person calling the function, and whoever wrote the function agree on where the arguments are, that's going to work out fine. So we just need some sort of agreement on where the arguments are, where the return value is, and so on. And this is the choice that everyone who makes compilers and libraries and operating system components for 64-bit Linux on x86 has made. And they've said that RDI is where the first argument is, then RSI, and so on, as listed here. And if you have more than six arguments, well, they couldn't just keep assigning registers to arguments. They'd run out. So there needs to be a backup scheme, and the backup scheme is that the remaining arguments are placed on the stack before the return address is pushed on the stack. Why before? Well, because call pushes the return address on the stack, so there's not really a convenient way of avoiding having the return address be the last thing pushed. And also we need a place to have functions return things. And the decision that they made is that we'll use RAX for that. And as long as the functions I'm calling agree that they're going to put their return value in RAX, and I agree I'm going to look for it there, everything will work out fine. But this is just a convention. We could have come to a different decision. We could have decided return values go in R8. And as long as both the function writers and the function users agreed on that, everything would work out fine. Now, this is sort of the summary. I'm missing some corner cases here. You might like wonder what happens with floating point, which if you know a bit about x86-64, you might know you usually don't store in these registers. Or what happens with like structs? We're not going to be concerned about that. You can look it up if you need to. I can point you to those resources if that's something you want. And you might say, okay, so I have to memorize this? I don't want you to memorize this. You can look it up. I give you a figure number in the book. Just want you to know it's there, and that if you want to figure out what a function does, for example, let's say you're doing the bomb homework and there's a function call and you want to figure out what are the arguments to that function, this information would be really helpful for doing that. So questions about the calling convention, general? Yes? So the question is the stack in the RAM? Yes, so stack is part of memory. So by the stack, I mean, so the stack which is pointed to by RSP and is in memory. Other questions? Okay. So when you typically see this used, so here I have an example of a function foo that follows our calling convention. So when we call it, we put the arguments in those registers. So in this case, I'm calling it with arguments 1, 2, and 3. So I put 1 in EDI, 2 in ESI, 3 in EDX. You might say, why am I using ESI instead of RSI? Well, because my arguments are ints, which are 4 bytes, so they canonically go in ESI. Also because, as we learned last time, moving a 32-bit value into ESI is the same thing as moving the zero-padded 64-bit value. So it doesn't actually make a difference in this case. And foo returns 42. It returns an int, so that goes in EAX. And it just moves that into EAX to do the return before it calls the return instruction, which is going to pop a return address from the stack and jump back to after this call instruction. So the call instruction pushes the address that of the instruction that that arrow would point to, and the return address pops that from the stack and jumps back there. And notice that our call and return instructions don't care anything about these arguments. This is just something the function is doing and the code around the function does and the return value by itself. Questions about this example? Yes? The return instruction pops an address from the stack. So initially, our stack is going to have, so let's say this function here is main, right? So our stack is going to have a bunch of main stuff. Then we're going to run this call foo instruction here. And that's going to, I should place a return address on the stack. And the return address is going to be a pointer to the instruction that follows foo in the assembly, or if there's no instruction there, it's going to be a pointer to that location, whatever's there. And then the pop instruction is going, sorry, the ret instruction is going to pop this off the stack, so it's going to remove this from the stack and jump to that location. And this is by adding and removing things from the stack. The way we do that is by adding or subtracting from RSP and looking at the location RSP, the stack pointer, points to. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes. The question is, if I want to add something to RSP, I have to increment it by 4, since we're dealing with ints. So in x86-64, typically we're dealing with 8-byte values, because that's the size of our pointers. So typically we'll modify RSP in multiples of 8. And the push instructions on x86-64 always deal with 8 bytes. There is no push 4 bytes instruction. If you want to add 4 bytes to the stack, you can do that, but you need to do it by adding and moving without a special push instruction or a call instruction or something like that. Other questions? Yes. So what does the L mean on the move? That means that it's a move of 32 bits instead of 64 or 16 or something else. We could have omitted all the L's, and this would still assemble, because the assembler would know, oh, it's EDI and so on, that has to be 32 bits. But I just provided it here for completeness. Other questions? Okay, so we mentioned what call and return does, and while we're discussing this, I want to make sure something is clear, because this is a common point of confusion. So the thing that call pushes onto the stack is the return address. It's the place we want to run code after the function returns. The value that we get from running a function is the return value. I'm going to try to be very consistent with that terminology, because they are very different things. But I know sometimes people confuse the two. Okay, so one other aspect of our calling convention that you hopefully vaguely remember from 2150 is that there are these rules about what registers you can use without saving their values. And the idea of that is that when we call a function, it's going to use some registers, and we want to know, well, you know, do I have to assume that the function changes all the registers I was trying to use or not? And this is another convention thing. We just make a rule that functions need to preserve these registers. And by preserve, I mean that if we call a function, when it returns back to us, they need to have the same value. That doesn't mean that the function didn't change those registers. And in fact, for the first one on this list, the stack pointer, probably the function changed the stack pointer by adding things to the stack and then removing them. But what's important is that the stack pointer and all these other registers need to have the same value when the function returns. So if the function does nothing with one of these, that's easy. The function just doesn't touch the register, it obeys this convention, it preserves these registers. Otherwise, the function needs to do some extra work, and the typical form you'll see, though not the only way of doing this, is that we can push the value onto the stack, you save it onto our temporary storage, which is the stack, and then pop the old value before returning. And this means that if whoever was calling foo was using R12, that we'll give them the same value back when we return, even though we might have been doing a bunch of stuff with R12. Now, if you call a function that if you call a function and you're using one of the registers that isn't on this list, then you have extra work to do, because you have to assume, even though it might not be the case, that whatever function you're calling is going to change any other register. So let's say, for example, other function here was using R11, and it calls foo. Because foo R11 isn't on the list of callee save registers, it's caller save. Other function as the caller needs to save it, or else it has to assume that foo will change it. And we have to assume that because we want other function to work no matter how the implementation of foo changes. And our guarantee is that all possible ways of writing a function, you know, are going to preserve R12, but not all of them are going to preserve R11. So to deal with that, one solution, not the only solution, is that we can save the value of R11 before calling foo and restore it afterwards. questions about these patterns for dealing with caller and callee saved registers and why we need them. Okay. So that's all the sort of overview of sort of assembly stuff. Probably most of what we'll go over. We'll have one remaining topic, which we're going to look at how conditionals work in assembly. I'd like to mention some things that you might see that we're not going to really cover in detail, at least not yet. So one is how you deal with floating point. So you might say, like, where is floating point? So floating point on x86-64 uses extra registers, these XMM 0 through 15 registers. There's also some related YMM 0 through YMM 15 registers you might see sometimes, and even some related ZMM 0 through ZMM 15. We're basically not going to talk about this. We'll mention it later when we talk about vector operations, much later in the semester. But there's a whole set of separate instructions for like doing floating point and things like that. There's also a feature in x86 called segmentation, which mostly isn't used, but it is used a little bit. In the bomb lab assignment, we have a note about a particular use you might see of the FS register, which explains what's going on there. But otherwise, we're not going to talk about segmentation. And the main reason why is that this is an x86 feature that for the most part has been abandoned, which no one else really did. Like if you look at any other architecture, they basically decided not to do this. But x86 has this peculiar feature that is mostly historical called segmentation that you occasionally see references to in assembly code. Also, x86-64 has a ton of instructions. And we're mostly not going to use those, not going to care about them. We're going to only care about a really small subset because, you know, learning extra instructions, you can look them up if you need them. It's not particularly interesting. And also, we're having you build a processor. You probably don't want to have to implement 1,000 instructions. Doesn't sound like a good use of your time. Okay, so questions about these topics we're mostly not covering? Okay. So I'm going to talk a bit about conditionals. And in 2150, you were probably introduced to this model for how you do conditional things in x86-64. And here we have an if statement, and I want to translate that into assembly. So my translation is going to be that I'm going to do the opposite thing. There's probably a way of doing not the opposite thing, but I think the simplest way is to do the opposite comparison. So here I'm checking if REX is equal to 0. And if it is, I'm doing this conditional jump that will skip over a call to foo. And the way I do that is REX equal to 0 check is this pair of instructions, compare REX to 0 and jump if equal. If the comparison was equal, jump to a particular location. Otherwise, if we don't jump, if it's not equal, we go to the next line as usual and run the call foo instruction. And we're going to talk about how this works in more detail because we're going to need to know that when we actually implement some of these instructions. And because it's nice to know sort of what the actual design is under the hood. And two things that kind of are glossed over when you just teach this is translation as there's this pair, compare, and jump. Because one thing is, how does the jump equal instruction know what the result of the comparison is? Where is that information stored? We're going to talk about that being in some special registers. And also, what happens if I add extra instructions between the compare and the jump equals? Is that going to make it still work? And we need to know like how things work in order to answer that question. So for the first question, how does the jump equal know the result of the comparison? So x86 has some special registers we call condition codes. And these are set by almost all arithmetic instructions. Now you might be saying, wait a moment. I thought to use jump equal, you had to use a compare instruction. So why are these condition codes set by almost all arithmetic? Like that seems like a disconnect, and we'll get into like what the motivations are for that. But this means that you didn't actually have to use a compare. There's other ways you could have made jump equal do or not do a thing. We'll go over how that works. And the condition codes store information about the last arithmetic result. So that answers another question you might have about this notion they're set by all arithmetic. You're like, what does it mean to set the condition codes after an add, right? Because an add isn't comparing values. Does it mean that we compare the values implicitly? No. So they're set based on the result of the arithmetic. So if we add two numbers together and get 17, that 17 is what they're going to be set based on. It doesn't matter what the two numbers we added together are. It's going to be based on the result of the arithmetic that we just did. So our conditional jump instructions, like jump if greater, jump if less than or equal, etc., read these condition codes. And they're named based on interpreting the result of this as subtraction. So preview is that the compare instruction is really a special subtract instruction. And jump if greater is named based on a subtraction, but it checks the same condition codes regardless, you know, because it's the same instruction. So another view we can have of this is that they're named based on comparing the result to zero. So why does this make sense? So let's consider jump if equal. If we subtract two values and get zero, then they're equal. If we compare a value to zero, then it's equal to zero. So we can also think of them as being named based on comparing the result of our arithmetic operation to zero. And that happens to allow us to compare values because when we get a result that's greater than zero, one was greater. When we get a result that's less than zero, one was less, and so on. Yes? This question, does the direction of a comparison matter? For less than and greater than, definitely, because the subtraction will be negative or positive.
Is it the same as intel, or
so the question is, what is the effective direction of the comparison? So as we briefly mentioned when we talked about AT&T syntax, subtract A comma B is subtract A from B, or B equals B minus A. And comp A comma B in AT&T syntax computes B minus A, and you can think of it, you know, implicitly we're comparing it to zero as far as what the jump greater than and so on will do. Other questions? Okay, so I've talked sort of at a high level about what these functions, what the condition codes are do and what they store, but let's talk in detail about what information do we actually put there. Because one model you could have is the condition codes store the actual last number, and that's not what the processor does. Instead, we store the summary that has the information we care about, like the greater than, less than. And there are two main components of this, which are called flags. So they're single-bit special registers. There's one called the zero flag. So this is set to 1 if the arithmetic result was 0, and set to 0 otherwise. So it's true if the result is equal, is 0. So for example, jump if equal checks whether the zero flag is 1, and if so, it jumps. Otherwise, it doesn't. The sign flag is set if the result is negative. It's called the sign flag because if you remember 2's complement, the sign bit is set to 1 if a 2's complement number is negative. So this is just a copy of the sign bit of the last arithmetic result. Now, there's something that's missing here. And that's, what if we do a comparison where the subtraction overflows? What if we're, you know, comparing, you know, int min and 1 or something like that? You know, that's going to overflow. That's going to give us the wrong result. How do we deal with that? And we're going to have some extra flags to tell us about overflow. And when we do that, we need to consider that, well, signed overflow is different than unsigned overflow. So int min minus 1, if we're thinking of signed numbers, that's going to produce the wrong answer. But if we think of that as something in a unsigned space, that doesn't overflow. That's just gives us the right answer. So we need to deal with that sort of thing. And the way we do that is we have two flags that are set based on whether overflow occurred or not. So one is called the overflow flag, which is, did the computation produce the wrong result if we interpret it as signed number? So did we do something like int min minus 1 and get a positive number, even though it should be still negative? And we have the carry flag, which is, if we interpret it as unsigned numbers, did we get the wrong answer? So did we like do as unsigned numbers like 10 minus 20 and get a huge positive number if we interpret it as unsigned? That means the carry flag should be set. Yes?
How would those errors come up?
So the question is, how would those errors come up?
Yeah, like how would you know, like a positive number come if you subtract from the number? Unless you're doing like...
So the question is, why would these happen in real code?
Yeah, like,
so if you think of doing a comparison, so the carry flag's probably the easiest example. So like if you compare 10 and 20 as unsigned numbers, well, if you do it in one direction, you're going to get a negative number, but that's not actually going to be something you can represent as unsigned. So the way you're going to tell is by using something that checks the carry flag. For signed overflow, an example is you're supposed to be able to compare int min and 1, for example. That should work. And in order to make that work, we need to have this overflow flag. So if we didn't have to worry about overflow, for subtraction, it would all work the same as far as our results for both signed and unsigned. But since we have to worry about getting the wrong answer, that's where we have a difference, and we have two sets of conditional jump instructions. So we have jump less than or equal, which are signed, and some related jump if below, jump if below or equal, which are unsigned. And the difference between these two is the jump less than and so on, use SF and ZF and the overflow flag to figure out what the result is, and jump below, jump above, and so on, use the zero flag and the carry flag to figure out what's going on. They can't use the sign flag because, you know, logically all unsigned values are positive. So the way you tell if you would have had a negative value is you look for the carry flag being set, meaning that you got the wrong sign of the result. Okay. So we're mostly going to kind of gloss over this overflow flag and carry flag. So we're going to have an assignment where you build a processor and you implement some of these instructions. And our solution to handling overflow is we're going to ignore it. We're going to produce the wrong answer. So obviously, in a commercial processor, that would not be acceptable. You would not like it if, you know, int min greater than 1 sometimes produced the wrong answer. But we're going to be OK with that, just to keep things simpler. So we're only going to implement the sign flag and the zero flag and the signed instructions. But I'm telling you about the other ones because when you're like looking at code in the bomb lab, you're going to see like a jump above or jump above equal. And that is in fact different than jump greater than, and this is how. This signed versus unsigned interpretation and set of which of these flags they're looking at is based on implementing that. So questions about all these flags? Yes. Sorry, which one is? Oh. I know. Other questions? Yeah.
Are you saying that like when you see like dating in your community, like what's the system these two numbers are comparing or unsigned?
So the question is when we see JB or JBE, we're supposed to assume the numbers we're comparing are unsigned. So the comparison is as if they're unsigned. The compiler may or may not be using it because their numbers are really unsigned, but it's as if they're unsigned. So for example, like if you consider things unsigned, that might like let you cheat on checking negative numbers in some cases. But basically the processor gives you a signed comparison and an unsigned comparison, and you might imagine, oh, the way it would do that is by having two compare instructions. That's not how it does it. It does it by having two different jump if instructions. Does that answer your question? Your question?
Can you modify these manually?
Can you modify the flags manually?
Yeah.
Yes. There are instructions to explicitly set or read the flags. I don't have them memorized, but you can look them up. They do exist. So they're needed, for example, when the operating system switches from one program to another, it needs to store the old flags of the program it's switching away from. So there's a way of doing that. And also related to that, if you're in GDB and you type info registers, one of the registers it lists is this thing called eFlags, for extended flags, which is basically this one value which represents all those flags together, and it helpfully decodes that into this list here. So here, there are these three flags set, PF, ZF, and IF. We didn't talk about PF or IF. And because SF, OF, and CF aren't listed, those must be zero. Yes?
So anything listed on there is a one, and anything not listed is a zero?
Question, anything listed here is a one, anything not listed is zero, yes. Other questions? Yeah.
What is JS?
What is JS? JS, I believe, is jump is if SF is one. So jump if signed, or signed bit, I should say. Other questions? So we've seen these condition codes, so let's look at an example here. So here I perform 20 minus minus 10, and I get 30. So if we think of how that works with our condition codes, well, our result is 30. So let's think of the zero flag. It's not zero, so the zero flag's gonna be zero. The sign flag, is the sign bit set? Well, it's not negative, so the sign bit's not set, so the sign flag's gonna be zero. And jump if less than or equal is going to look at that and say, well, I'm looking for something that's zero or negative. I'm looking for the zero flag being set or the sign flag being set. Neither of them are set. I'm not going to jump. Some questions on how I figured this out? I said, you're asking about the direction?
Yeah. Oh,
yes, it is in fact, so it's first from second. Other questions? Okay. And we could have different outcomes depending on what we're dealing with. So for example, if we did 20 minus 20, we get zero. And JLE would be taken because the zero flag would be set to one. If we did negative 10 minus zero, we get negative 10. That would have the sign flag of one, a zero flag of zero, and the JLE would be taken because it's the sign flag is set. Okay. Questions about how you figure out the condition codes in any of these examples, or anything else about them. Okay, so I mentioned this idea of the last arithmetic result. So comp, what is comp? Comp is subtraction that just forgets to write to a register. So it does a subtraction, does all the flag setting for the subtraction, but forgets to store the result anywhere. So using a subtraction is the same, except it actually outputs to its destination register, compare, just skips that step. There's a similar instruction you might see called test, which does a bitwise and forgets to write to its result. Most commonly, you'll see test register, comma register, like test RAX, RAX. And the way bitwise AND works, as we'll discuss probably next week, is that if we AND something with itself, we get the same thing. So this means that the result is just the value of RAX. So for example, let's say RAX is 0, then ANDing RAX with RAX gives us 0, and 0 is 0, so we'll set the 0 flag to 1. 0 is not negative, so we'll set the sign flag to 0. So for example, if we had a jump of equal afterwards, well, it's equal to 0, or the 0 flag is set, so that jump of equal would be taken. Some questions on these just only condition code setting instructions? Yes? Am I saying that test Q does subtraction? No. So test Q does a bitwise AND, which is not subtraction, but like compare, it doesn't store its results. So there's also an instruction called AND. So test is like similar to this instruction called AND, just like compare is similar to subtract. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So to clarify, compare basically does the subtraction and sets the flags.
The question is, compare does the subtraction and just sets the flags? Yes.
And then jump just to the
flags. And jump, yeah, and the conditional jump instructions all just look at the flags. Other questions? Okay. So I've told you about like subtract sets condition codes. I said most arithmetic does. So what exactly does that mean? So most instructions that compute something do it. So we have compare, test, we have all the arithmetic instructions, but there's some exceptions. And for some of those exceptions, you might say, wait a moment. LEA, we learn to compute an address. Move, well, it needs to compute an address to move to an address. You call, like it computes a location on the stack, why don't they set the condition codes? And the answer is because the processor designers decided they shouldn't. So I'm telling you here which ones do and don't. If you have an instruction you find for x86 and you're not sure, you need to look it up because, well, the reason it does or doesn't set the condition codes is because the processor designers decided it should or shouldn't. Like LEA, it wouldn't be insane to have it set the condition codes, they just decided not to. So we have our compare instructions, and this is more typically what you see used with condition codes. You might say, why did we bother? Why did the processor designers bother having all these extra instructions with these handful of exceptions set the condition codes? You know, because typically this is what I want to do. I want to do a comparison and jump if less than or something like that. I don't want to do a set a value and overwrite the things I was comparing and then jump because I got rid of the values I was comparing. Like usually that doesn't make sense. So why do they think that this was a useful design that they should have every single instruction almost, or at least a lot of instructions set these condition codes when usually we wouldn't use them with conditional jumps. So one reason is that it's kind of free, is that they needed to add circuitry to like see if a value is zero, and there's not much cost to having that circuitry run all the time versus just on compare instructions, because you know it's not something you can easily reuse for other operations. Another reason is that if you write your code in certain ways, you can commonly take advantage of the condition codes being set implicitly. So for example, here I have a pattern that's relatively common. I have a loop that counts down from 99 to 0. And the way this loop works is I subtract, and then see, am I at 0? And as long as I'm not at 0 yet, or not below 0 yet, I go to the top of the loop. And because this is a compare to 0, well, that's already what we kind of implicitly do with our, you know, condition codes, how they're set. Or alternately, like, we're comparing the value before the subtract to 1. It would be what we do by using the condition codes we got from the subtract we were already doing. And so I can just omit that comp instruction, and the effect's the same. That subtract sets the condition codes correctly because I want to test if it's still greater than or equal to 0, and that's exactly what jump if greater than or equal to does. It says, was the last arithmetic result greater than or equal to 0? And this sort of pattern comes up a lot, or you can even like restructure your loops to make it happen. So you know, the condition codes kind of let you avoid explicit comparisons in many cases. And that's sort of the design philosophy behind why they might be a good idea. Why the x86 designers decided it was good to have all these instructions implicitly set, these condition code registers. So questions? This example, yes.
Are those collie or collar saved for the flag and all that?
So the question is, who is responsible for saving the flag registers in the calling convention? And the answer is that they are collar saved if you care. Typically, even though the condition codes like won't be changed by a lot of instructions, typically the pattern you'll see is you'll have an instruction that sets the condition codes immediately followed by one that uses it, so there won't be any chance for a function call to interfere. Other questions? Yes.
Foo is just arbitrary?
The question is, foo is just arbitrary? Yes. Foo is just there to make the loop do something. Other questions? Okay, since we've seen condition codes, let's do this exercise. So I have some code here. I don't tell you what the initial value of the registers are. Assuming there's no overflow, what are the possible values of the condition codes, SF and ZF? The ones that we're going to care about for the rest of the semester, since we're kind of ignoring overflow. You can talk with your neighbors a bit, something like that. Okay, who'd like some more time? No one needs more time? Okay, so let's see who thinks A is possible. Thinks B is possible. Okay, a few less people. Who thinks C is possible? A few people. Who thinks D is possible? Okay, so we have the plurality answer is that A and B are possible and C and D aren't. But I agree, so let's go over first the simplest thing to eliminate, which is D. And the problem with D is that those flags tell us we have our last arithmetic result was negative and zero. That's not possible. So, and the sign flag means actually negative, not non-positive. So that's just not possible. That can never happen. At least from, you know, unless we like set the flag explicitly. So then C. So C would be telling us that the result of our last arithmetic was zero. So first of all, we have to look at this assembly and say, where's the last arithmetic result? And that's going to be the add instruction here. So the add is what our last piece of arithmetic is. Yes, it's not usually what we use to set the condition codes, but that's the last arithmetic. It's an instruction that sets the condition codes. So the question is, what are the possible results of this add? And is one of them, for C, zero? So we've eliminated D. So the way I think about this is, I'm going to represent the initial value of RCX as X. So RDX is, so we have RDX is going to be equal to X, and RCX is going to be equal to X. Then RDX becomes X minus 1, and then RCX becomes our final result, which is going to be X plus X minus 1, which is going to be equal to 2X minus 1. And the question we're asking for C is, can that be 0? So if I solve 2x minus 1 equals 0, I find out that, oh, x has to be 1 half. And we can't put 1 half in an integer register, so that's not possible. So C is not possible. As for A and B, we can come up with examples where we get those results. So if I start with 0, I get RDX becomes negative 1. 0 plus negative 1 is negative 1. That has a sign flag of 1 because it's negative, and a 0 flag of 0, so that's B. If I start with 1, I get 1 plus 0 because RDX becomes 0, and that's positive, so that gives us A. Sign flag of 0, positive. 0 flag of 0, it's not 0. So questions on how I solve this? Yes?
You can never have non-integer numbers in these registers?
So the question is, I said there can never be non-integer numbers in these registers? Yes. So if we wanted to deal with floating point, there's a separate set of registers and instructions for that. So the normal add instruction doesn't add floating point numbers together. You need a different instruction for that. Other questions? Yes. How B works? So B is possible. One example is if we start with 0. Then if we start with RCX being 0, then RDX becomes negative 1. Negative 1 plus 0 is negative 1, which should have a sign flag of 1 because it's negative. Other questions? Yes?
You just said one example. Is there another example where that's possible?
Is there another example where we get a negative, where B would be the flag setting? Yes, so negative a million.
I thought, you're saying RCX.
If RCX is negative a million, for example.
That can be an address for a register.
So the value in RCX is a number. It's of up to 64 bits. This code never tries to access memory, So we don't care if anything's a valid memory address. It doesn't matter unless we're trying to access memory with it. Other questions? Okay, so that's about condition code. So let's start applying condition codes, and you've probably at least hopefully remember doing something like this in 2150. I'm going to try to go through how do we go from C code like this systematically into assembly. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the semester, one of the reasons we're using C is because there's a direct correspondence to assembly, even it might not be what the compiler ends up doing. So the way I would translate this to assembly is that I first start with this intermediate form of translating it to C with go-tos. So I follow my pattern that I want to skip over the then part sometimes, so I negate the condition. So the condition is if B is greater than or equal to 42, so I say, don't do that if B is less than 42. And I write this if go-to. So go-to is a thing that exists in C that you usually shouldn't use, but it's handy for translating to assembly because, well, our assembly instructions look very much like that. We have a pair of instructions we know do this if go-to line. That's why I chose to write it that way. And after the then part, we don't want to run the else part, so I just use a go-to to skip over it. Some questions about my translation to this go-to C before we do the next step. So the reason I, yes, sorry. So I say you usually shouldn't use it. I'm not saying you should never use it. But I guess I would say you shouldn't use it for this because you have an if statement. And that's much clearer. There are cases when I think it's okay to use go-to and C, but this is not one of them. And all our examples will not be them because we'll like start with a while loop or an if statement or something that you should probably write as a while loop or an if statement. Other questions? Yeah. The question is that bottom code is C code that will compile? Yes, assuming you declare variables and so on. Other questions? Okay. Now, the reason I wrote this sort of C code is that I can sort of manually go line by line and produce equivalent assembly that might look like this. I do turn my if go to a compare conditional jump. My add becomes an add instruction. My unconditional go-to becomes a jump. Hence, my multiply becomes an imol instruction. If you don't have to memorize that, you can look up what the multiply instruction is if you need it, and so on. So this has a very direct correspondence to assembly after I do that transformation, even though it's not obvious when we start with the C, you know, what the assembly might be. So questions on how I got this assembly code? Yes. So the question is, how did I choose to use RBX and REX for A and B? That was arbitrary. And I felt using RBX for B and REX for A was probably clearest. Other questions? So let's do this exercise. So I have some assembly. Let's which C code, which of these is equivalent? Talk with your neighbors. You might want to write things down. I probably would. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, a few people. Okay, who'd still like more time? Okay, not seeing. So who thinks it's equivalent to A? Okay, B, C, D, none of them? No clue? Okay, anyone like to defend their answer? Okay, so that's a good observation. So we probably, this code modifies RBX and RCX, so we better modify both of those. Okay.
Yeah, and again, I'm eliminating A and C because for that one, the last slide, which is adding to RX, RCX, the JE skips that if the zero flag is one.
Okay, so you're like, oh, so you saw a comparison to zero, and you're like, wait a moment, JE does the opposite of that. Okay. Okay, so I like this idea. Unfortunately, B is also wrong. The answer is none of them. The key thing that's a very common mistake on this kind of exercise is that the JE, it's a jump if equal, but it's skipping over something. So this would be right if we had an exclamation point equals here. And that's a good observation that, wait a moment, we're checking if something is equal, but that's skipping over the code that's not taking that, doing that add. It's not doing the add when it's equal. And otherwise, A is our best answer. So the problem with B is that, remember that our condition codes are set based on the result, which is now stored in RCX. So we want to know if the new RCX is zero, not if the new RCX is equal to RBX. So that's why we shouldn't have B. And there's a similar problem with C. Yeah.
So for the jump equals, is it comparing the value of just argsec or like the result of adding rbx?
So the question is the jump equal using the value of just rcx or the result of adding rbx and rcx? So it's the result of the last arithmetic. So for most purposes, that's just the same as saying rcx. The only case where there might be differences is when we have to deal with like overflow, but for equality, that doesn't come up.
It's because we're updating the value.
Yeah, because it's based on the last result of the last arithmetic, and the result of the last arithmetic, in addition to being stored in the flags, is stored in RCX because the last arithmetic was that add instruction. Other questions? Okay, so we've seen translating sort of if statements to and from assembly. Let's talk about loops. So I have simple while loop here, and I'm going to use the same sort of philosophy to translate it to assembly. I'm first going to translate it to C with go-tos. So the condition at the top, I'm going to use the same strategy. If the opposite of that condition is true, so if x is less than 0, in this case, that's the opposite, I want to skip the loop, otherwise do the loop, and at the end of the loop, rather than skipping over something like with my if-else case, I want to go back to the beginning. So this is my C with go-tos that I end up writing, and I then translate that line by line to assembly. So I look at my if-go-to, and I say, okay, that's compare followed by a conditional jump. My call to foo is a call instruction, and then I need to subtract from my loop counter, and I do that, and jump to the beginning. And I chose to use R12 for the loop counter, so I don't need to worry about saving registers for foo, because that was a callee saved register. And this is one possible translation of this loop. It's not the only one. The same was true for my if-else examples. There were other things I could have done. I could have probably moved the code around and had reversed the comparison. There's other ways of arranging this, but this is what I think is the most straightforward, and this gives you an example of why we're using C, remember, because there's this straightforward translation to assembly, but it's not the only choice. And we kind of saw this earlier when I talked about, oh, we can remove compare instructions, so that's something that you might try to do, but that I didn't bother doing because I did the most straightforward translation. So questions about this translation? Okay. So let's look at another example. So here I have a kind of similar loop. I have three things that are close to and possibly actually translations of this loop to assembly. Let's assume B is an RBX, and that's callee saved, so we don't need to worry about the call to foo messing it up. Which of these are correct? I'll give you a minute or two to discuss with your neighbors. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, a few people. Okay, so let's see. So who thinks A is possible? Census. B? C? Okay, so we have broad consensus that A isn't possible, and the easiest way to see that is that if B is initially 20, A calls foo one too many times. That B is correct, which it is. And we have a plurality that think C is wrong, but not so much consensus. C is very close. So we can just do a subtraction of a temporary value to do the comparison. Like, that would work. Unfortunately, we just did the wrong subtraction. We did the subtraction in the wrong direction, or the comparison in the wrong direction, because it's the opposite of the as a subtraction we're doing in version B. So questions on how I came up with these answers? Yeah. Did I write JL or JLE? I wrote JLE. Other questions? Someone, nope, okay. Okay, and so I showed you there are multiple ways of writing the while loop, and you'll see that in practice if you look at compiler output. But your question first? Oh, never mind, okay. So for example, here's three different ways real compilers compiled with different settings this while loop. So can someone give me some reason why would the compilers prefer the second or third version? Why would they have generated that? What's the advantage? Or is there any? None. Yeah.
I guess if they're just executing instructions in a row, then they can load up on those extra instructions so they don't have to guess where the next instruction is going to be.
So you're thinking maybe it's better for fetching instructions? Okay, so you're thinking that this avoids, which version are we talking about?
I guess the second and third. Yeah.
Second and third, so let's look at the second. So you're saying we avoid what?
I guess the first two lines, they're already loaded now. And then, I guess that's saving time.
Okay, so you're saying there's something about these first two lines not being in the loop that's going to save us time. So I like that idea, but I'm not quite there. But there's something special about them, yeah. Yeah, you're...
So in the first loop, we have four instructions that we're looping over. In the second one, it looks like we have three. And the last one, it looks like we only have two.
Okay, so you're looking at, in this first loop, I have to execute all these every loop. In the second loop, I have to execute these three. And those first two instructions you identified are sort of part of how we're saving those things. So here, what we've done is we've moved the comparison to the bottom of the loop, but to make that work, we need to have a comparison before the loop to handle the first iteration. In this third case, the compiler made the loop only have two instructions that really matter, because this is the loop ends here. And the way it did that is by turning this into a loop that goes from something up to 10 to a loop that goes from something down to 0 by doing a bunch of algebra. And that eliminated one further instruction. Now, is this optimization worth it? The answer probably is yes if you do enough loops, not if you don't. Yes, your question?
On the right hand column, the DCT, I believe a decrement, that's an implicit comparison.
The question, does the decrement do an implicit comparison? It's arithmetic. Yes, it does. And I'm not done yet. Thank you very much. So one last topic I'm going to mention for today. There's something that's less straightforward to translate into assembly, and that's switches. So there's three strategies you'll commonly see compilers use. So one is the translate it into a bunch of compare and jump it, conditional jumps. But that obviously seems silly. You might come up with better ways. So one better way you might come up with is a binary search. And sometimes compilers will do this. But there's another strategy which looks kind of strange in assembly, which is called a jump table, that the compiler will generate an array of pointers to the code for each case. So in this case, I have table, which has a pointer to the code for case 1, for case 2, case 3, and then I have this jump instruction here that does a lookup in that table. And if you remember when we talked about conditional jump syntax, or computed jump syntax, what this is going to do is to give in our table, let's say rax is 2, we're going to say table minus 8, that's our displacement, plus rax times 8 is going to get us the second entry in this table. And that's going to have a pointer to the actual code we want to run for case 2. And so our switches here are an example of something where the translation to assembly is not so straightforward. We have these three options, which all make sense, and you'll see compilers use all of them. And that's probably because it's one of the more complicated things we know in C, like as far as control flow stuff. And it's one that's less straightforward to translate to assembly. And that's where I'm going to finish up for today.